Well, greetings, and welcome to the show. This is Wrong Place, Right Crime. I am your host, Frank Zaffiro, and this episode we are going to chat with Gabriel Valjean. Now, Gabriel is a fixture in the crime writing community, very popular guy with other writers. One of the reasons is he's just super supportive of other authors, and obviously we all appreciate that. But another reason is that he has a very unique voice, and his writing style is very much a signature style, all his own. And so when other writers read that, we notice and enjoy it. I've been fortunate enough to read a couple of his short stories, and he sent me his first book. And the style is there throughout, even if the voicing is a little bit different depending on the particular work. So who is Gabriel Valjean? He is a Boston-based author at present, although if I'm not mistaken, he grew up in the New Jersey area. He was an author that I reached out to for a Grifter song when I was looking to fill out the fourth season. And he wrote Diamond Dogs, which is set in Newark at a hotel just not far from the airport. And definitely, again, a very unique voice in that episode. You should check it out. Diamond Dogs in a Grifter song. But he writes several different series, and we're going to talk about each of them, so I won't put any spoilers up front. And he's an interesting guy, very intelligent. I think you're going to enjoy my conversation with him. And so rather than listen to me, let's jump right in and listen to him. So here is Gabriel Valjean. Well, hey, Gabriel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Well, technically, it's not your first time on the show. Okay. You submitted a written response to my questions regarding a Grifter song.
Yes.
And I read those on the air. So it wasn't you, but your words have been on the show already.
Understood.
So looking at your work, you have got three very different series, in addition to some short stories, on your, CV. And I just thought maybe we could, do a quick walk through these three different series.
Okay. So, I do have three series. The first one I had written, which is six books. It is called the Roma series, and it is about a woman forensic accountant that's pretty much on the lam from her former employer, and she goes to Italy, believes that she's incognito. She has a relationship there. She has a life there, and her boyfriend is involved with the essentially what is the version of the Italian financial police. And he essentially starts talking cases with her, and she starts lending her expertise. She becomes an ally and a colleague to his friends who are also in the police force, and they have a series of adventures. Each book is set either in Italy. I have two of them where she comes back to Boston for different reasons, and we see her relationship with each of the individuals on the team. So there's five books for that. The sixth book is actually a precursor to the series where I explain the motivation of each of the five men and why they joined law enforcement. Each individual has their own experience with crime, particularly organized crime. They all different ages, different experiences, different parts of Italy. So at the moment, I have six in that series.
So this series, the Roma series, is this set in the present day?
It is set in the present day. Because one of the characters is on the older side, you get some back history with Italy. You know, like I said, each book is a different adventure. The first one is about archaeological theft. Someone is stealing valued artwork as it's being discovered, which is something that happens all the time in Italy. Somebody might be doing construction in their house. They find a fresco. They find a statue. There's a lot of laws in place to stop the construction, have it examined, have it verified, have it preserved. So the first book is about archaeological theft, and Bianca, my main character, proposes that they set a trap for whoever's doing this. They will claim that they found a lost eagle from one of the Roman legions and see who comes out of the woodwork for this.
And so there's five more of these after this. Most of them take place in Italy, as you mentioned. Did you or have you traveled to Italy? Have you been there?
Yes.
Or are you a lot?
I would say a fair amount. I went, what turned me on to Italy was I went as a teenager, and then I went as an adult. I spent quite a bit of time there after I finished my master's degree. The first time I went, I was more in the south. And the second time I went, I spent a lot more time in the north. And I pretty much swept from west to east and then came back to Milan. I was there in Milan when Paolo Borsellino was assassinated. So that left a powerful memory. It instigated my curiosity as to what he was doing, why he was killed. His predecessor or colleague, Giovanni Falcone, had been assassinated. Both men basically were killed by bombs. And the assassins ultimately were the Sicilian Mafia. But both men were pioneers on how they attacked organized crime. And it actually influenced Giuliani in New York and how he would use the RICO laws. So that's kind of where my love of Italy started. It was an eye-opening experience for me because what I knew about Italy and Italian culture was primarily Italian-American, New York, New Jersey area. And when I went there, the language was very different. It wasn't the dialect of immigrants. I also saw a lot more to the culture that went beyond cliches and stereotypes. And I just fell in love with it. The food, the people. So when I decided to start writing, I latched on to this idea of seeing different parts of Italy, different characters from different parts of Italy, their culture, their traditions, so I could introduce readers and expand maybe their understanding of Italian culture, that it's beyond, let's say, The Sopranos or what they see in a movie.
Well, the intrigue that you talk about there is actually a good segue into one of your other series called The Company series. And how many books are in that now?
There is three. I am currently writing the fourth one now. The Company Files is historical. It starts in 1948 in Vienna, and it is that transition between the OSS, Office of Strategic Services, into what became the CIA. People need to be reminded that the Soviets were our allies during World War II. However, at the end of the war, or as the war was ending, the Soviets were first to liberate the camps. And what they did was they seized anything that related to the sciences, to engineering, and they boxed it up, put it on the train, and sent it back to Moscow. So we became aware that they were stealing all this, taking all this vital information. And one of the things that the U.S. was very concerned about was what they do with atomic weapons. So the first, very first book in the series, The Good Man, is about recruiting Nazis for the rocket program here in the U.S. And that was actually based on an operation called Operation Paperclip. I used that as the basis for my inspiration. And I'm writing the fourth one now.
You know, I'm a history guy, and I've talked to a few other writers who have written historical fiction, and I've not done very much of it. And so I'm always curious, how much research did that require?
The first thing I try to do when I do my research is I want to make sure I have the timeline right, that, you know, whatever details I put in there are not anachronistic. So there's research, and then there's reading, rereading, fact checking. The other thing I try to do when I do the research, and this is where the imagination comes in, and this is kind of where flight and fantasy happen, is in my research, I try to really get a sense of character, especially a historical figure, get a real sense of what their personalities were like. And all my characters, you know, I hopefully try to show their good side and bad side, because these individuals, we're looking at them 50, 60, 70 years after the fact, so we have a lot of hindsight for interpretation. Some of these characters at that time really believed that what they were doing was the right thing. Their methods might have been crude. The technology certainly was different for, let's say, spycraft, but they really thought that there was communists under every bed. They thought there were people that were going to betray this country. So there was that sense of reality, but at the same time, there were people like Dulles and Hoover who had very set ideas about their responsibility and what power they should have. And as I said earlier, nobody knew what they were doing. There really were no checks in place. And it's reading it as a writer, it's really scary how things could have gone sideways very fast and in a very dangerous way on a global scale. But it's a lot of fun as a writer to explore the history. You learn things that you didn't learn in school. So it's fun.
Well, writing an alternate history, you know, is a whole subgenre of, I guess, technically science fiction, but, you know, sometimes it could be just as much a mystery as anything else. And it is fascinating because, as you point out, as you read history, you see so many vital pivot points where, you know, had this happened just an hour later, had this person, you know, not gone to the play that night, you know, things like this, where the very small change, the very small decision that is made differently could have, you know, the butterfly effect for that, the ripple effect would be tremendous. And so I think that when we look back at those kinds of things and do those sort of counterfactual examinations, that's the closest we're going to come probably to the precarious situation that those people sometimes found themselves in. I mean, they didn't know what was going to happen next. We do, right?
Well, one of the things I found fascinating about history, I'm just saying this in a general way, the U.S. was very, very fortunate that they had the right people at the right time. You think about Lincoln, if it had not been him and it had been another personality, who knows what would have happened. When I look at the Depression in World War II, you know, you wonder what would have happened if we did not have FDR. And writing this fourth book, I realize, you know, the fourth book, it takes place in the half of 1953. So at this point, you know, to remind listeners, FDR is long dead. He died in 1945. Truman had taken over when FDR died. But what was really interesting about Truman, and he was criticized for a long time, but I think now his reputation is being reevaluated and people realize what a job he did, because while he was vice president, FDR kept him in the dark. He literally attended no meetings and basically walked into the office after he got news that FDR died. So, you know, he got on the horse, got in the saddle, and, you know, did the best he could and did a pretty good job. But Eisenhower, who is the president in 1953, it's an interesting contradiction, because here's a man who was a general during World War II, although I don't think people realize that Eisenhower did not see combat. Truman did. That fact really shaped the presidency, because Eisenhower relied heavily on his advisors. And who did he have as his advisors? The Dulles brothers. And they took advantage of him, and they pretty much ran the show. John Foster Dulles was the Secretary of State. Allen Dulles was the first civilian director of the CIA. The CIA, when Truman signed it into effect, had originally assumed that somebody from the military would be running the CIA. And he was rather ruthless about human life compared to somebody like Truman or others who had seen combat. So these are all things that you, as you're doing research as a writer, you encounter and reassess, compare with what you learned in school, and then see where your imagination takes you when you do a what if.
Well, those sound fascinating. That's an interesting time in American history and definitely worth delving into. Now, in addition to all of your novels, and we're going to turn to the Shane Cleary ones here in a moment. But I wanted to touch on the fact that you've also written a fair number of short stories, many of which have been nominated for awards. And as I was looking down your list of different anthologies that you were in, there's too many to list here. So I'm going to be selfish. Turns out we were both in the Writers Crushing COVID anthology that came out. And that Lawrence Kelter did. We were both in the Dark Yonder anthology, the one that kicked off Eric Pruitt's bar there, which that has evolved into a literary
and what was the third one?
Magazine. Backroad Bobby and His Friends. And all three of those, actually, I didn't read your entry in the Writers Crushing COVID, but the other short stories of yours that I've read, you know, people talk about unique voices. You most certainly do. You're there's no question when I'm reading Gabriel Valjean that I'm reading Gabriel Valjean. And then I picked up your most recent Shane Cleary book that you sent me, and right off the bat, bang, it's that same voice. It's a different voice because it's a different character, but underneath it, you can still hear that same author's sort of touch on the character. So tell me a little bit about Shane Cleary. We're five books into this one now.
We're five books in. We see an arc from book one through book five. Shane is a former cop. The series takes place in Boston in the 1970s. He is also a Vietnam vet. When he came back, he tried out the police force. That kind of went south for him, but I won't get into that. But the point is, he's now a PI. He's trying to make a living. In the first book, we see him, struggling to pay the bills. He's trying to get a client base. He's living in a small apartment with a cat named Delilah. One of the things I try to do in my series with Shane or anything I write is I try to build relationships. So here in the Shane Cleary, he has a friendship with a friend who is still on the police force who is closeted. This is the 70s. He could not come out gay without serious ramifications. He inadvertently becomes friends with a mobster. And he eventually develops a relationship with a lawyer, a woman named Bonnie, who's a criminal defense lawyer. And he has a friendship with a black bar owner and his wife, Sylvia, who Sylvia runs a small restaurant. But the ambiance is the 70s. It is not politically correct. But I would argue that while I write hard-boiled, I don't get too dark. I try to have some kind of sense of humor. I try to in all my writing. I don't think people realize that humor is actually probably one of the hardest things to write because
absolutely,
you can be off-key or what you think is funny might not be funny. One of the things also that I had to be careful of with the Shane Cleary series, but I also enjoyed it as a challenge, was to balance what was not PC about the era. I think I actually toned it down a lot more than what the reality was. I was a kid during the 70s, and when you're a kid, you take things for granted. Things happen, people say things, but when you look back at it, you realize, oh my God, I can't believe we thought we talked that way or we did things that way. But it was a different era and a different time, and I try to capture it. One of the things that was enjoyable about writing Shane is that I lived the era, so I could draw from my own personal memories, unlike the company files where I had to really do some serious research because I wasn't alive during that time period. With the Roma series, the research is different because you're doing things through a cultural lens. I can write about Italy, but I can't write it as a native because I'm an American. With Shane, it's a little bit more like coming home. The only difference there is I'm not originally from Boston, so I kind of have to superimpose my experiences from New York and New Jersey onto Boston. So the research there had to do with place names, places that I wouldn't have known about as a child. But again, like everything I've written, it's about relationships. It's about trusting each other. It's getting through a hard spot. There is a lot of ambiguity. The mobster I created, for example, is probably the most ethical person in the whole bunch. You know, he has a set of rules, and he lives by them, which I don't think people would expect. So I hope they enjoy it.
Now, I have to ask you, the first book in this series is called Dirty Old Town, and that is coincidentally the title of a song by the Pogues, which is an Irish sort of band. And, of course, Boston's a very Irish town. So is there any connection there, or is that just a coincidence?
No, I called it Dirty Old Town. You know, I think I may have lifted that as a lyric from either the Pogues song recently. Shane McGowan recently passed away. I don't know if he had a song named Dirty Old Town, but I remember it appeared in one of his songs as a lyric. Then there was a website called Dirty Old Boston. So between the two of them, I came up with Dirty Old Town. Yes, it is an Irish town, but one of the things that I thread in throughout the entire series was the diversity and the ethnic tension during the 70s in Boston. And I'm very quick to remind people that Boston was the last city in the United States to desegregate for both schools, public housing, and for those who know the newsreel, busing. Right. It was a very, very violent time. And the Italians didn't like the Irish. The Irish and Italians didn't like the blacks. No one used the term African-American back then. So if you looked at Boston at that time in the 70s, and it still persists to today, you have these ethnic enclaves. You know, the area that Dennis Lehane's writing about is South Boston. I have Shane living in the South End, which is not South Boston. The South End at that time in the 70s was primarily Latino, a motley group of ethnic groups getting by. The South End was basically a byproduct of the 50s, where jazz and music clubs, it was kind of the New England version of the Chitlin Circuit. Then you have the suburbs, you know, that are wealthy, WASP, some areas that were Jewish. As I said, those enclaves sort of still persist today, but they were far more rigid in the 70s.
Well, the fifth one is coming out this month, March of 2023, and it is called The Big Lie. It is book number 5. From what I've read of it, I haven't finished it yet, but from what I've read of it, the hard-boiled tone is definitely laced with some lightness and some, I wouldn't call it gallows humor, but it is a slightly tinged with a darkness sort of humor. It's got a little bite to it, but it's not really mean in humor. It's actually kind of light. I definitely think if that's the kind of humor you like, you would like this book here. One thing I noticed and I wanted to ask you about just as a kind of a storytelling or craft point is you in these books, you title each chapter. So it's not just chapter one, it's, you know, chapter one, the job, or chapter one, the deal, or, you know, whatever you choose, you're naming each chapter. What went into that decision?
I thought it would be different. You know, I read a lot of crime fiction, and I thought I would give the idea of a, you know, I know people are kind of divided about this, but I gave each chapter a title because I wanted to give the reader something to look for, whether it was thematic or maybe pique their curiosity to keep them in the game. I was also looking at chapter titles as a way of doing pacing, you know, just rather than having a number. It also gives them kind of a mental bookmark. But that's kind of the way I was thinking about it. You know, I don't know how readers look at it.
I liked it as a reader. I liked it, and partially because it was different and partially because it did provide a little bit of a mystery or a little bit of a street sign, something for you to look for. Mm. So that is out and available now. And then I think you said you're working on the next book in the Company series at the moment.
So yes, I am currently working on the fourth Company file, which is slated for 2025. For Shane, this is The Big Lie, number 5, and I will need to make a decision whether I will keep going with the series. So I'm hoping that readers like it and respond to it. In terms of the overall arc for Shane, this fifth book is a serious milestone for Shane because, you know, as the title says, Shane discovers something that completely alters his landscape on how he views the world and how he's viewed his life. In terms of the actual mystery that he's asked to solve, it's basically a lost and found case. You know, he's hired by an enemy to find a missing dog. And it's quite interesting that the person who hired him had once tried to kill him. So I guess when you have to pay the rent, you take the job.
Yeah, for sure. So where can people find out more about The Big Lie, the fifth Shane Cleary book, and about you, Gabriel Valjean?
Sure. I do have an excerpt, if you're curious about it, on my website, which is GabrielValjean.com. I provide excerpts, usually the first chapter for each one of my books. The Shane Cleary series is available on Amazon. There are reviews on both Amazon and Goodreads if you want to get a lay of the land. The publisher is Level Best Books. You could check out the publisher's website, find out, you know, more about what I'm doing, find out other authors at Level Best. They do plenty of mysteries, all different types of crime fiction. In addition to my website, I also have a blog, which is Gabriel's Wharf at WordPress.com. There, you know, I occasionally put up essays at the moment. I've been working on the Agatha and Anthony Awards eligible lists to help people in the crime fiction community figure out who they want to nominate. And hopefully that creates a slate for who they can vote for when they attend the conferences.
Well, the first chapter excerpt there is called Chapter 1, Brother Rat. And the first line is dialogue, and it says, "A dog? You want me to find a dog?" So talk about a hook. You know, I mean, you read that, and you, and when I read that, I was pulled in right away. So
thank you.
Gabriel, I want to tell you thanks for coming on the show, and also on behalf of all those other authors out there who have received support from you in one fashion or another. I'll also say thank you for that. You're a very conscientious and diligent member of the crime fiction community, and a lot of people are very aware of that, I think. I certainly am. So thank you for coming on the show, and I'll look forward to seeing you at the next conference.
See, if you see me at the conference, please stop by and say hello.
All right, there you go, folks. Gabriel Valjean, like I mentioned in the intro, very interesting guy, very intelligent guy, and writes a, you know, three very different series. And I think that's pretty cool when authors do that. I like doing it because it's a palate cleanser. And of course, as an artist, you're always looking to explore different areas. But it's not always easy. Sometimes you find your wheelhouse and that's what you're best at. And other areas, maybe not as much. And so not everyone takes that approach. And certainly Gabriel has. And those three series that we talked about are, I think, quite different from each other. And that's intriguing. So I enjoyed that interview very much. I hope you did as well. Coming up next episode is actually a special episode in April. In May, we'll have the From the Conference Floor episode from Left Coast Crime. So if you are going to be at Left Coast Crime, please reach out to me or find me at the conference and we will do a quick hit interview. We're talking 3-4 minutes, you know, who you are, your latest book, some points of interest, just to introduce you to the listener so that people can find new authors to check out. So we'll do that in May, but the next episode will actually be next month in April, and it is a special episode. And all I can tell you is I won't actually be hosting it, and I'll leave all the rest up as a mystery. All right, I think I'm going to skip any Zafiro update this episode. We'll talk again in the next episode about new books that are out and so forth. However, I'll just remind you that I do have a direct sales store now, and you can access that directly from my website. It's right in the upper left-hand corner of the menu bar. It just says store, so it's pretty self-explanatory. They're at the Code 4 Press bookstore. All of my books are up there now in digital form. They are a dollar cheaper at my store than they are at retailers, so you can save a little money. And as new books come out, they will be available at the store for an extended period first before they go wide to Amazon and Nook and Kobo and everywhere else. So if you want to pick up the latest book or any book at a bit of a discount, you can do that at the Code 4 Press bookstore. All right, folks, that is all for this episode. I want to say thanks to Gabriel Valjean for coming on the show, and to you, the listener, for being here, for sticking with the show as we've gone through a format switch for 2024. And I'm glad you're here, and I hope you enjoyed the interview with Gabriel. Remember, next episode, special episode in April. Tune in and find out what it is. Until then, this is Frank Zaffiro reminding you that sometimes you gotta be in the wrong place to write crime.